All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
This is Good Together, the podcast that inspires you to create change in the world every day. I'm your host, Laura Alexander Wittig, CEO and founder of Brightly, the number one destination for conscious consumers around the world. At Good Together, we value the planet over perfection and believe that you can make positive things happen for the planet every day by being a conscious consumer and an informed citizen. Listen in as I chat with various experts about living and consuming responsibly.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hi, Good Together listeners. I am so excited to welcome Dr. Louis Ziska to join us on the podcast. And the reason why I'm so excited is because it is currently allergy season and Dr. Ziska is quite the expert in the space. At time of recording, I myself am dealing with allergies like most of you probably are. And the reason why we wanted to talk about this on the Good Together podcast is we read a recent report that said that allergy season is actually said to be earlier, longer, and worse, all due to climate change and greenhouse gas emissions. So today I wanted to welcome Dr. Louis Ziska to the podcast. He's an associate professor in the environmental health sciences at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University and was part of this report that I just mentioned. So welcome, Dr. Ziska. I wonder if you can do a brief intro of yourself and your background.
Yes, my name is Lou Ziska. I am an associate professor here at Columbia University. Prior to coming here, I was about 25 years with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and I've spent a great deal of my research looking at sort of the nexus between global climate change, plant biology, and public health. And part of that nexus includes looking at changes in allergenic pollen, and how those changes are being influenced by both rising carbon dioxide and changes in the climate.
I mean, that is quite a way to, you know, attack the problem, I'd say. And I'd also bet that you, like most of us, probably suffer from a little bit of seasonal allergy woes. Would that be correct?
You would be absolutely correct. I suffer quite a bit from seasonal allergies, allergic rhinitis. I've had times when it's gotten induced asthma as a result, and I always carry my inhaler with me wherever I go.
So it's something that obviously is a very personal problem to you, as it is to me, and I would say most of us. And actually, you know, I think what has been so fascinating to me as I, you know, dug into the report and as I really thought about, you know, allergy season in general, it's something that we, I think, have been conditioned to just live with. Right. And we have a variety of ways that we can cope with our allergies, such as medications or, you know, in some extreme instances, possibly moving to different parts of the world. But I would say overall, what really struck a chord with me as I was reading this report was, you know, the situation has gotten worse in recent times, and it's not going to get much better based on what we're currently facing with the climate. And so I wonder if we can talk a little bit about, you know, if you can kind of give the listeners a really brief overview about what your report found, and really maybe how you went about the methodology would be fascinating.
I'll certainly try. Being a scientist, however, just keep in mind that I like to talk. So
that's fine. You're on a podcast.
I try to make it as short and to the point as I can. Basically, it's pretty straightforward. We know that carbon dioxide is a source of carbon to make plants grow. It's one of the resources that plants need, along with water and sunlight and nutrients. And about 90% of plants lack optimal CO2. So when you hear someone will say CO2 is plant food, and yes, but it's also plant food for poison ivy. It's also plant food for things that produce, you know, ragweed and other things. So one of the things we've been looking at is the role that recent and future changes in CO2 will mean in terms of plant production for these allergenic species and how much more pollen that they will produce. And of course, the 12-ton T-Rex in the room is climate change. And what we're seeing with that are warmer winters, earlier springs, where the last frost might, if it was occurring in April, now it might be occurring in March. If you had frosts in the fall, if they were happening in September, well, now they're happening in October. And all of this is to say there are two main takeaways in terms of plant-based allergens. The first one is you're being exposed to allergens over a longer season. The number of frost-free days from spring to fall is now increasing, and so you're going to be having a longer experience with those pollen. The other issue is that more of the pollen is being produced. As plants respond to warmer temperatures and more carbon dioxide, we see increases in the amount of pollen that are occurring, and then you have to breathe in as well. There's a third issue that is somewhat tentative, and that has to do with CO2 itself, whether or not it is affecting the chemistry of the pollen in such a way that the pollen may be becoming more allergenic. There have been two published studies on that, one for ragweed, one for oak, but both studies suggest that that may also be occurring. Now, there's a postscript to this, and that has to do with molds. What we're seeing in some locations, particularly that are warmer and wetter, and also especially after a severe storm, is that molds can grow and flourish. And molds are also a source through spores that they produce. Those spores can also become highly allergenic.
Yeah, I mean, in general, I think, you know, those three buckets that you identified are so interesting. Of course, each one of them, you know, has very, you know, different implications. But to me, I would say, like, from the perspective of somebody who is not a scientist and is just, you know, obviously casually observing what's going on. I mean, number one, I definitely feel like I've observed more pollen of the same type of plant, right? Like I feel like we've had multiple times recently or in the past few years where you come out and your car is just like covered in it. And I was like, gosh, I really don't know if I remember this happening growing up. But the thing that is really interesting to me also is the last point that you made about, you know, pollen perhaps becoming more potent and the addition potentially of mold now playing a role is very interesting. And the reason why I would like us to dig into both of those things as well, listeners, is number one, if you've ever gone to a specialist to be tested for allergies, so it's quite an ordeal. I also suffer from allergic rhinitis, meaning I have a lot of sinus problems that stem from being triggered by allergies. And I remember, you know, my doctor and I worked through as much as we could. And finally, the doctor said, okay, well, why don't you go get fully allergy tested? So there's a variety of ways to do it, but none of them are overly pleasant. And the thing that I remember coming out of that testing was thinking, wow, okay, there's definitely some things that irritate me more than others. But if you consider the wide scope of you know, things that can be classified as irritants to somebody, it's actually pretty large. So when I made that comment earlier about, well, maybe people are going to move different places, to me, it sounds like there's not a lot of places you can escape what we're talking about. Would that be right, Dr. Ziska?
they're not. Some of the places that you might go to are places where it's very dry or very cold, that they don't support the kind of plant life that would be associated with pollen production. That, yeah. that's certainly a possibility, but it's probably not the best possibility if you like greenery.
Antarctica.
And you like nature.
That's right.
As far as irritants go, I'm still waiting for one for coworkers, but so far that's not happened.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, when we hear about the problem, we feel a little bit validated by what we ourselves are seeing going on from a personal perspective. And so when we talk about, you know, maybe those three buckets that you identified, like, was there anything that stood out to you in your experience of, you know, of being in this space for so long? Was there anything that stood out to you as particularly surprising that came out of the study?
I think the thing that was really surprising was how general it is. It wasn't just when we started, we were looking at it from a kind of a localized area around Baltimore. But as we did a deeper dive, it was clear that this was happening both not only in our state, but also at the continental level. And eventually we were seeing it for the Northern Hemisphere as well. We're trying now to look at what's happening in the Southern Hemisphere. There are fewer pollen counting stations there. And very different species that are associated with pollen. But that's also something that we'd be interested in and are trying to pursue that line of, research as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating. And I think in general, from my perspective too, another thing that stood out to me, in addition to like the broad scale and scope of what we're talking about, is also the amount of people that are affected. So, you know, according to the CDC in the U.S., about 25% of adults and 20% of children in the United States are affected by allergies. And I mean, that to me seems a little bit low, but we'll go with that. And, you know, unfortunately, there's just so many different health implications and complications that can come from this problem. And oftentimes when we talk about different topics related to climate change or sustainability on this podcast, people occasionally will make the comment to me about these being nice to haves, or, you know, oh, if you can do better, then do what you'd like to do. But in instances where we're talking about our health being directly impacted, to me, the urgency it just can't be overstated. So I'm curious to know a little bit about, you know, as you went about the course of your study and you know, found some of these findings, was there anything that, you know, really made an impression on you that could be done from a consumer perspective? Or, you know, maybe we can talk a little bit about, like, now that we know the problem exists and that it's getting worse, like, what are your general recommendations coming out of this study?
In terms of treating or avoiding or...
Well, we can talk about it a few ways. Yeah. I mean, maybe we talk about it from, like, perhaps the initial portion that people can do on their own, such as treating or any kind of recommendations you might have from that perspective. And then maybe we can talk a little bit about some of these systemic changes that could be interesting.
I think from a very practical point of view, trying to stay indoors, obviously, when there's a lot of pollen in the air is good. Don't hang your clothes out on the line if it's a high pollen day. Try to take a shower or wash yourself off when you come in from outdoors. Check your air handling system. Often what occurs is that you don't turn your AC on until June.
Yep.
And then a lot of things can accumulate in there over time.
Okay.
So that when they first come on, you can be absolutely blasted with a lot of different allergens, both from pollen, but also, of course, from spores and molds. So those are sort of the pragmatic ones. In terms of systematics, I think that's a much harder issue to get to.
Yeah.
In the sense of what can I do to make climate change go away? As it turns out, there's actually quite a bit you can do at the individual level, and that ranges from being politically active to watching the kinds of food that you eat. It turns out that many of the foods that are the worst for you have a very high carbon signature. And if I just switch from just eating beef to eating chicken, that can save a tremendous amount of carbon. So there's a lot there, and that's probably outside the scope of what we can do in the remaining time. But I don't want people to feel hopeless. I think that they have to understand that as an individual, there is a great deal you can do to make a difference.
Absolutely. And I mean, the reason why I kind of jumped to this was because, you know, I think most of us are familiar with, you know, pollen and sort of what's going on from a natural perspective. And you've really done a great job about informing us, about some of the findings coming out of this study. And so when we think about, okay, number one, as an individual, I can do things like, you know, not going outside and when it's particularly bad and all the other tips you shared. But then yes, like thinking about it from a broader perspective, I think it can be slightly overwhelming to people and sometimes potentially, slightly depressing. It's like, okay, well, I really like where I live and I want to be able to go outside and hike and do all of these things. And so, you know, number one, I think what's fascinating about this is it really does bring the issue of climate change home. It is something that's directly impacting all of us around us. But I also think, you know, when we consider allergies, it becomes even more interesting. And, you know, the report, like you mentioned, specifically says that cutting greenhouse gas emissions is ultimately the most meaningful action to slow the rate of warming. And from an individual perspective, you're very correct. Like food waste and food consumption is a huge, huge portion of individual greenhouse gas emissions. Of course, transportation is another one. I would say with most of us, you know, we probably cut back a lot of our transportation as of late with working from home and all those things. But, you know, I do think that it's worth mentioning. And then, of course, you know, plastic production and, you know, any kind of industrial manufacturing, all those types of things, of course, do also increase emissions. So just thinking about reuse and not wasting. But, you know, another thing that I wanted to ask you, Dr. Ziska, was specifically around, regional case by case, potentially, tips that we can give people or maybe even just findings that you found. So let's say that like, I currently live in the Pacific Northwest. There's a lot of greenery. There's obviously a lot of things going on. But one finding that I've had is as I travel, I might be going to a place that has quote unquote less greenery. So maybe I'm going to a more desert or arid place, but my allergies still don't seem to let up too much. So I'm curious to know, you know, when people ask you, oh, well, you know, I guess I just have to go to move to Antarctica. Obviously, that's not realistic. So are there other like regional things that people can be on the watch for or potentially like, you know, is there maybe like one common irritant that is maybe more plentiful in some parts of the country versus others?
It's interesting that you bring that up because if you look at specific irritants, I think one that really stands out is ragweed.
Yes.
It's interesting. If you go back to the 1920s and the 1930s in New York City, where I'm currently living, the city actually had, I don't know how would you describe them, ragweed gangs that would go around, prisoners who would go around and cut down ragweed that was growing on Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
Right now in Switzerland, talking to some of my colleagues there, if I have ragweed growing on my front lawn, you call up the administration there, the police or the hospital, they will send people out to your lawn to remove the ragweed.
Wow.
I know. So it's something that is really recognized, I think, by most people. We used to recognize goldenrod too, but we learned that goldenrod isn't really an allergen per se. But ragweed is. And to give you some sense of just how powerful it is, I'll tell you sort of a couple of things. First of all, a normal ragweed plant can produce a billion with a B pollen grains.
Wow.
Pollen, it can produce so much pollen that actually back in the 1960s, during the Cold War, the Brookhaven National Laboratories put out a cluster of ragweed plants on Long Island that they used when they all flowered and they started putting pollen in there. They used that to simulate what future nuclear fallout would look like.
Oh my gosh.
So that will give you, I couldn't make that up. That will give you some sense of just how much pollen a cluster of ragweed plants can produce. So the other thing you need to know about the plant is it really thrives on disturbance.
Okay.
If you have snow cleaning equipment, which I assume you do, not you personally, obviously, but
sure.
if you look at where they go, and if they go off road, and they might make a curve into the grass and disturb the soil, and then you come back the following year, I will bet serious money that you'll see a lot of ragweed plants going where the soil has been disturbed.
Really?
Yes. So when you look at land use, when you look at disruptions, new buildings, new roads, whatever, that's one of the things that is almost inevitable when you have that kind of disturbance, is that ragweed will follow. And so if you're looking to try and make a difference as a weed warrior, if you will, then this is something that I think it would be very interesting to try and follow up on, is to, you know, keep track of what's happening with ragweed. But in fairness, you could keep track of a number of things. What's happening is that as the climate warms, things that insects and weeds and bacteria and other things that had not been seen previously are now starting to be seen. So
yeah,
if you have tick
exactly.
You have tick migration happening in the Northeast, you have kudzu, which is an invasive vine now showing up in Oregon.
Mm.
There's a lot going on with the environment that isn't really captured in the sort of icons of climate change, like polar bears. I feel sympathetic for polar bears, don't misunderstand me, but that is sort of difficult for the average person to relate to climate change by looking at a polar bear.
Yeah.
However, you can relate to it if you're sneezing your head off. So that's, sorry, I'll stop there.
No, that's fine. No, it's fascinating. And actually, I was going to mention ragweed because I know that it really is that top irritant. And I'd say my brother got married last October in Texas. And so October in Texas is still very warm. And he mentioned he actually suffers very poorly from seasonal allergies. And he said, it's the most beautiful venue, but there's a bunch of ragweed around it. So like, we are going to really limit, you know, the amount of time we spend outside, you know, because it's just, it's rough. And it was, I mean, it was just like this field of yellow. And I'm so interested to learn more about what you mentioned about the disturbance, because I think, you know, as we consider the impact that our industrialization or just general urbanization has had on the environment, there's so many different vectors, but even thinking about things like, you know, disturbing soil, which then increases potential ragweed is so interesting. I'm curious to know too, like, so are there any sort of, in addition to us like going and pulling out ragweed, like with our hands, like, are there anything that are any like things that are happening on the natural end of things to stop ragweed? Like, are there certain animals that eat it, or is there any kind of like natural mitigation going on, or is it pretty much unchecked?
It really is related back to disturbance. The best way to control it is to make sure that the soil that you have will stay undisturbed for a longer, like 3 or 4 years. And what happens is that the vegetation will build up in such a way when it's not disturbed that ragweed will no longer be able to get a foothold there. So if you see it, you obviously want to remove it. It's a pretty plant. I had an experience once where I was giving some flowers to someone, and I looked down at the bouquet and I thought, that looks like ragweed. And it was. So being a botanical mind, so it's something that you want to control where you see it. But the best way to control it is through, by natural means, is to make sure that you have other things that are growing there, and that those things stay there, that they stay there for a long time. Ragweed is an annual plant, so it has a season. It comes, it flowers, it dies, it produces a ton of seed. But if you can keep it from seeding, that's always a plus. There's an old adage in the botanical world that says that one year's seeding equals 7 years weeding. So if you have a weed in your garden and it flowers, you're going to have to be removing it for at least 7 years more. In the case of ragweed, that doesn't really apply. If you can get rid of it for the first year, usually it won't come back.
Wow. I mean, I think that's just, it's fascinating, and I think it's something that's important for us all to be on the lookout for. So yes, I mean, listeners will obviously include photos of ragweed and things of that nature in our show notes. But yes, I kind of like the concept of becoming a weed warrior, as you said, Dr. Siska. It's very interesting. I mean, at the very least, you could look at your immediate surroundings, right? Like if you happen to be, you know, in a home that has a backyard or something like that, right?
This just one word of caution. Like many weeds, it isn't just one kind of ragweed. There are a lot of different species. And so you have everything from Western ragweed to giant ragweed. And each of the pollen, the kinds of pollen that are produced are slightly different in terms of how much of an allergenic response they produce. Common ragweed is probably the worst. But it's not hard to find. You can Google any of these things, see what they look like, and then have a chance to take them on based on what you've observed.
And once you have, you know, grabbed it out of the ground, what's the best way to dispose of it? I mean, is it something that if you just lay on top of your, lawn, I would imagine it's going to continue to spread. Is that correct?
Once you pull it out, it will die. The trick is to try and do that before it flowers. And one of the things that's unique about ragweed is it's what's called a short day plant. It will not flower until the days get shorter. So it will only start to flower after June 21st, which is the longest day of the year. So usually by the end of August to October, until the first frost, actually, it will keep on flowering. So as long as you get it before the time, early on is best in terms of destroying it. If it does have seeds on it, then the best thing to do is to put it into a bag, put it somewhere where it can't, those seeds can't get back to the ground.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's so interesting. I mean, like, who knew that it would be so fascinating to talk about weeds? But I mean, truly though, it is something that, like I keep saying, it affects all of us more than we can even think. And so Dr. Siska, you know, I can't believe we've almost come up on time. We could probably get into many other things, but I'm curious to know, was there anything else in the study that you feel like we didn't talk about in the podcast that you feel like people really need to know, or do you feel like we covered everything?
I think we covered almost everything. I think there is one topic that relates to allergies and the change in climate that we know a little bit about, but we'd like to know more. And that has to do with food allergies. We know that changes in carbon dioxide, changes in temperature will affect how plants grow, including the plants that we eat. But one of the questions we have is how does that in turn affect the allergic potential or the allergenic potential of some of those plants? So we published a study, only one I've seen, unfortunately, looking at a variety of peanut, which showed that more CO2 was in fact causing the peanut to become more allergic. That's not to say that's the be all and end all by any stretch, but it's an aspect, I think, when it comes to allergies that we really need to know more about.
I totally agree. And actually, this is something I had my first child about a year and a half ago, and I've been thinking a lot about, you know, allergens in food, just like you mentioned, and thinking about how do I prevent any type of these allergies with her. And of course, there's, you know, theories and, you know, some studies that say, yes, like, exposing children earlier on to certain things can help, but there's also not a ton of evidence for that too. So it suffices to say that it's a bit scary to think about, especially when you hear about stories of folks that are just so allergic to you know, peanuts, for instance, like you just mentioned. I'm really curious to hear more about that too. So it's fascinating to think that, you know, there's a potential link here, right?
Exactly. And it would be really nice to do a granular exploration of what that link might be and how prevalent is it.
Yes. Well, if that starts going off, you'd let me know because I want to know. You got my contact information.
I'll do my best.
That's right. Well, Dr. Siska, this has been such an interesting conversation. And so what I typically like to do with all of our guests is ask them a similar question. So sometimes it's the same one, but it varies from episode to episode. But I'm curious to know, like, from where you're sitting, so either, you know, from a personal perspective or professional perspective, what is exciting you the most about what you're seeing happening in the ethical and sustainable living movement right now?
In ethical and sustainable?
Well, I mean, you know, you could even talk about, you know, in the sustainability movement in general, like sort of where, what you're witnessing.
I think the probably the most exciting thing in, is really from a food perspective. And that is, I think that people are really becoming more aware of what it is that they're consuming from a food context. And what that means in terms both of their health, but also in terms of what it means for carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas mitigation. I think that in the last couple of years, I haven't become full vegan, but I've certainly changed my diet to cut back on meat. And I think that's made me a little bit healthier and a little bit wiser. I still have a hot dog at the ball game, though. Don't tell anyone.
There you go.
But I'm trying. I'm trying to make a difference in that. And I think that that's one of the things that, as I mentioned, we can do on a personal level that will both help the environment, but also help in terms of our health. And I think that's something that I find really exciting, is that awareness of folks with respect to what they're consuming and how they're consuming their food, I think is very important.
Absolutely. Well, I couldn't think of something that's more appropriate to end on as I sit here and consider my lunch. No, I'm just kidding. But, you know, in general, I think you're absolutely right. There is such a exciting movement going on with people just rethinking what we're eating. And like you mentioned, you can have a hot dog at the ball game every once in a while. Like that is totally part of being, you know, the human experience. But thinking more about like meatless swaps is fascinating. And listeners, if you're curious, my favorite meatless swap right now is that viral TikTok feta pasta. That thing is the easiest thing. It's meatless. I wouldn't say it's not vegan, meatless though. So good. Check it out. Well, anyway, Dr. Ziska, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciated the conversation.
Thank you so much. I really, really had a lot of fun. Thank you.
Joining us on another episode of Good Together. To get show notes and more, head to brightly.eco/podcast. Finally, don't forget to join in on the conversation with us on social, where I know you can find us at brightly.eco. Don't forget, we're all on this journey together, so have fun putting the planet first and stay curious.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.